From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Emily Fox in for Cynthia Canty. Today, why kids from Central America are risking their lives to come to the U.S.
Those kids don't have water, they don't have electricity, they don't have anything to the point that they take a trip to go and try to find something like that.
And millennials, we've got a bad rap. So what happens when the me generation starts to take over the work world?
Millennials are America's largest and most diverse adult generation.
Then, the future of college radio. If student-run community radio disappears, what's lost?
You know, they're being sort of taken over by these sort of public radio empires that are doing, you know, I mean, often it's, you know, good radio, but it's radio that you can hear someplace else on the dial.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Most portraits of millennials aren't very flattering. We've been described as lazy, entitled, shallow, and we're expected to dominate the workforce by the year 2025. I'm Emily Fox, in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll hear how that generational shift will impact the working world. But first, today is primary election day in Michigan. But there's one thing that might be missing from the polls. Voters. Many political watchers expect very low turnout for the primary. In fact, some say Michigan could see an all-time low number of voters at the polls today. Jake Neer is Capitol reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Emily.
So what's keeping people from the polls?
It's too early to say at this point exactly what's motivating people staying away. But, I mean, some speculation that, for one thing, there's nobody at the top of the ticket in primaries for the governor or for the U.S. Senate races. And that's, although, something that we've seen a few times since the low water mark in 1990. That's the lowest amount of voter turnout we've seen. And so it doesn't really explain it. There are some other things like, well, it's summer, maybe people are away, that the primaries are so crowded, and that there's some confusing proposals on the ballot. But, you know, those are things that we've seen before. So we'll have to wait and see what exactly is motivating people to stay away.
And as a good reporter, you've talked to a couple political analysts, and they're saying this low turnout might actually be a good thing for certain candidates. How so?
I talked with Matt Marsden with Rev 6 Data Systems yesterday, and he's, you know, tracking absentee voters and ballots. And he said that for candidates like Tea Party back candidates that have more motivated voters, that could be good news. So, you know, it's not bad news for everybody, just for democracy.
And with the way the district maps are drawn in Michigan, many of these races actually will be decided in this primary rather than in November. Is that right, Jake?
That's the big deal. It's that, you know, with the way that the lines are drawn here in the state, that every district is so Republican or so Democratic that the primary is really where you choose, you know, who's going to end up in that seat. So with low voter turnout, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that.
Jake Neer is Capitol reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Emily.
There's been a lot of talk about what to do with the surge of children from Central America crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And there's a real possibility that some of those children could be coming to Michigan, to the towns of Vassar, Bay City, and Farmington Hills. Oscar Dusan understands why these children are risking their lives to come to the U.S. He's the executive director of International Samaritan. It's an organization in Ann Arbor that provides programs and outreach to extremely impoverished communities across the world. And I mean really poor communities, where people are literally living in trash dumps. Oscar has done a lot of work in Central America. Welcome to Stateside, Oscar.
Thank you, Emily.
Based on your understanding of the living situation in Central America right now, why is it that a lot of these kids are risking their lives to flee and cross the U.S.-Mexico border?
Yeah, the situation is I was actually in Guatemala some days ago, and that was one of the questions that I asked one local. And he said to me, his take was this. He said, you know, parents used to take the lead first. You know, they would leave their families behind and they would go and send money. Now, that's more difficult now. Now, the parents who stayed, usually the mothers, are sending the kids to go and look for their fathers, or this is the explanation that he gave me. Mothers believe that nothing is going to happen to the kids because they're kids. Something like, you know, like a crusade that let's send the kids to fight because they're kids, nothing is going to happen to them and God will protect them. So that was part of the explanation that he gave me. And there's some truth to that. If you see the amount of kids coming right now, there might be something happening in the way that people don't touch them. And if you ask me, I think it's working some because they're getting more and more. So that is going back to Central America, and they're getting the news that people, the kids are making it here. And when something is successful, you continue doing it.
And so it's you're saying it's the parents that are sending these kids. But what are some of the misconceptions about America among those people that do live in Central America?
Well, it depends on the country you go to. If you go to Honduras, I was talking to a Catholic bishop some years ago, and he told me kids here only look at the north. There's no other future but the north. If you go to Guatemala, in some areas, they also think that to get their own house or to, get out of poverty is to make it here somehow. They've heard all kind of stories, but I believe it's something like winning the lottery. You know, when you see $300 million in the lotto, you think that you're going to win it no matter what. Chances are not on your favor, but you believe it. And I think that's part of the reason why they continue to come.
And a lot of people, when we've heard the news or read the news recently, people are saying these kids are fleeing because of the high violence and the high poverty. Talk a little bit more about that situation right now.
Yeah. The kids that we serve, they're in severe and chronic poverty. When we discovered the dump 20 years ago in Guatemala City, we saw kids in cardboards with no genitalia, no noses, no ears, because mothers would put them in cardboards and then go and recycle. Rats would come and eat those parts of their bodies. And that's one of the things that we see. A lot of kids who have been attacked by rats. We see people struggling for the resources of the dump. We're talking about dogs, cats, rats, vultures. So that's kind of like part of the reason why they're coming and why they see hope. But on the other hand, there's a lot of violence right now. There are two different gangs taking control of the population of the areas in which we serve. One is the gang called 18th, and the other one is called the Mara Salvatrucha, or MS. And they fight for territory. Some of the kids that we serve, they have gone through things like this. They, of course, the gangs try to recruit them. One of our kids who's going through one of our programs, he said, "No, I don't want to join either one." Well, some of those gang members put firecrackers in his mouth and then just started the firecrackers. You will see it today. He's still going to school. He knows this is the right opportunity, but those are the things that they have to face every day.
Wow. And so it almost seems that when we're hearing about, these kids are risking their lives to cross the border, why would they risk their lives? I mean, despite the challenges that they may face when they come to the U.S., it's almost like life's better here anyways.
Right. And let me talk about me just one second. The situation in Central America right now is, especially for these families, is so desperate that coming here, taking the trip, getting into the on the train, risking their lives is even better than staying where they are. If they stay where they are, they know something is going to happen. Again, it's like winning the lottery. They think they're going to win. In my case, I come from Colombia, and even having studied and, having jobs down there, my parents would tell me, go to the north, go to the States, because the opportunities are there. I could have gotten different jobs, but these kids, they're not trained. So I believe part of the solution, which is what we're trying to do, is to give them the instruments and the resources down there for them to stay. And we have seen that working.
And that leads to my final question. What should the U.S.'s role be and Michigan's role be in the situation happening right now with what's happening in Central America and the fact that these kids are trying to come to the U.S.?
Well, let me divide the answer in two. One time I was in Haiti with some kids from high school here in the U.S., and one of the kids pointed out to me after the earthquake that there were some tents with USAID, that there, it was very clear the name. And then he asked me, how come we have this right here? And I said, well, your money, your parents' money is here. Do you want your money to come here? And he said, yes, I do, because I see what it's doing. And I said, well, in that case, remember, you're going to vote one day. And when you do, think about this. That's one part of my answer. The second part of my answer is I think we have to support organizations that work directly with the people down there. Many people ask us, why don't you help the people in Detroit? Why don't you help the people in Saginaw? Well, difference is huge. You know, those kids don't have water. They don't have electricity. They don't have anything to the point that they take a trip, long trip, to go and try to find something like that. So we put those resources, I'm talking about you and me, $50, $100, $25, in organizations that work directly with the people down there. Then we will be able to build an infrastructure for them to see that there are some resources that they can use. Finally, the other thing that we can do as Americans is we should go visit them. And, you know, there's a lot of questioning about this. Why would we go instead of paying? And, you know, why don't you put the money into donating instead of buying an airfare and going down there? The answer is very simple. Imagine that you're at the hospital and people send you flowers. But imagine that instead of flowers, 100 bouquets of flowers, 100 people come to see you. And not only that, bring the flowers with them. It's the same when we go down there. Our international program director was in Honduras a couple of weeks ago, and he told me people were crying because they think, you know, somebody cares about us. And that little touch in the back makes a big difference as well.
Yeah. Well, Oscar Dusan is the executive director of International Samaritan. It's an international outreach program based in Ann Arbor. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily.
You are listening to Stateside. I'm Emily Fox, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Let's go back in time for a minute. It is the end of July, and I'm sitting in the back of a boat, an anchored boat, by the way, and I'm looking out, and I see about a dozen islands or so, and those are only the ones that I can see in sight. There's actually probably around 50 within a 10-mile radius of me right now. So where am I? I'll give you a hint. I'm on one of the Great Lakes. You might think, maybe it's Michigan. You know, it has all the nice, beautiful sunsets. Everyone goes there for their vacations in the summertime. Or maybe it's Lake Superior, where it has some massive storms, big waves, gobbles up the Edmund Fitzgerald. It has ice still on its surface early into the summertime. But what about Lake Huron? You never hear much about Lake Huron. Well, my friends, Lake Huron is where I'm sitting right now. Lake Huron is home to what is called the North Channel. Thousands and thousands, it seems, of islands. It's kind of like the Bahamas, but it's more like instead of sand and palm trees, you get rocks and pine trees. But there's heaps and heaps of islands here, and it is the most beautiful place I think I've ever been in the Great Lakes region. So the question is, my friends, why does Lake Huron get a bad rap? Now, live from Michigan Radio Studios in Ann Arbor, we are joined by someone who lives and breathes Lake Huron and doesn't understand why Lake Huron seems to be the little brother of the Great Lakes that surround our state. Roy Eaton is the weatherman and newscaster for the North Channel. His broadcast airs every morning at 9 in the summer on VHF radios. Those are those little handheld walkie-talkie radios that boats have. Welcome to Stateside, Roy.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
Now, Roy, just to make sure everyone's on the same page geographically, tell us where the North Channel is located.
North Channel is on the north side of Manitoulin Island. When you take a look at the Great Lakes and you see Lake Huron, go to the far north. You'll see an island called Manitoulin, and by the way, it's the largest freshwater island in the world. And in the water on the north side, that whole area is called the North Channel of Lake Huron.
So basically it kind of hugs the southern part of Canada and then the northern part of Manitoulin Island, which I heard takes 4.5 hours to cross from west to east or east to west.
That's about right, yeah.
So, Roy, you've been boating your entire life and you've sailed all of the Great Lakes. Which one is your favorite?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. It's right here, Lake Huron, North Channel.
And can you talk about the difference between sailing on Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, and Lake Superior?
Well, we certainly did enjoy our time in Lake Michigan. We were down to the Manitous, and we went across to Green Bay and Sister Bay, Fayette, Escanaba, those different places. So, yes, that was very nice. We sailed on Lake Superior. We found it very, very isolated. There were very few boats around. You're pretty well on your own up there. Spectacular beauty with the high cliffs. Very spectacular, but anchorages and safety is few and far between. If you get in trouble, you're on your own. And here in the North Channel, we have equally spectacular vistas, but we also have the safety of a more enclosed area. At any given time, you're always within an hour or two of an anchorage that'll protect you from whatever strong wind might be coming in. And so you have the beauty and you have the safety at the same time.
And I should also mention that you've sailed from Bermuda to Antigua. That's a long journey on the Atlantic. And you've also spent time sailing in the Florida Keys, the Virgin Islands, and the Bahamas. And yet you say that sailing Lake Huron's North Channel is your favorite. That's surprising, but you know what? You would not be the first person to say that, because when I was in the North Channel, a lot of people that have sailed all over the world said the same thing. So what is it that makes the North Channel so unique compared to these tropical islands that you've also sailed around?
Well, as you say, they certainly are beautiful, the different parts of the world. If you do go to the international boating magazines like Cruising World and Sailing, you'll consistently find in the summertime the North Channel being rated number one or number two in the world. Some of the things that make it that way is, geography is one. Along the North Shore is the Canadian Shield. It's the oldest rock in the world, about 3 billion years old, we're told. And at one time, it was higher than the Alps, higher than the Rocky Mountains, at a time in history when it didn't even exist. And as you sail along the North Shore, you go from the beautiful pink granite of the Canadian Shield up by what's called the Benjamin Island area to the eastern end of the North Channel. And down there in Killarney area and in Bay Finn, you have the white quartz. And in speaking of Bay Finn, for example, Bay Finn is the only true fjord in all of North America.
And if you want to discover the North Channel but don't have a boat, no worries. You can rent a boat or charter a boat from some of the bays on Manitoulin Island. We'll post the links on our website, and I'll post some pictures of the North Channel, which is the Great Lakes' best-kept secret. My guest is Roy Eaton, sailor extraordinaire and the voice of the North Channel's VHF radio program, Cruisers Net. Thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for your interest. And to those listening from Lake Michigan, we'd love to see you.
And we'd love to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside.
You're listening to WDBM East Lansing. This is MSU Student Radio.
And you are listening to 89.1 FM WIDR Kalamazoo.
You are listening to Grand Valley State University's only student-run radio station.
Reggae Revolvers, brought to you by Michigan's number one college radio station, 88.3 WXOU.
College radio is dying. At least that's according to a headline I saw recently. With music libraries packed into smartphones and laptops and websites like Spotify and Pandora, college students aren't listening to music in their dorms from a portable radio anymore. So what's the point of college radio? Should we save it? My next guest is Jesse Walker. He's a former DJ at WCBN, Ann Arbor student-run community radio. He's also author of Rebels on the Air, an alternative history of radio in America. Welcome to Stateside, Jesse.
I'm glad to be here.
So, full disclosure, I am a product of college radio, and it wasn't more than 2 years ago or so that I was hanging out in the basement of Holden Hall at Michigan State University at their student radio station there. And I remember walking the halls, and almost when I would see my friends in the hallways that had happened to be in the same building, they would say, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm working at the student radio station." They said, "What? We have a student radio station here?" They had no idea. And from our anecdotes, it seemed like the students wouldn't know we had a student radio until they were maybe upperclassmen and started driving. Not until they actually started driving around town, they would realize that
MSU had a student radio. So my question to you is, what's the point of college radio if so many students aren't even listening?
Well, you know, I should say that when I was a student at the University of Michigan, and that was more like a quarter century ago than 2 years ago, there were lots of students who didn't know about the station then either. I mean, it was a presence on campus, maybe more of a presence than your station was. I don't know, but if you weren't really interested in music or in one of the subjects of the public affairs and programs, and if you didn't come across one of the events on campus, you might not know about it. It was a big campus. So that's not something that came along with, the Internet. That's always been just a part of the facts of, broadcasting way over on the left end of the dial. People aren't necessarily going to come across it. But it was still very valuable. It was very valuable for a lot of reasons. Number one, we were putting together great broadcasts a lot of the time. I got to say, within, the sort of risk-taking amateurish ethos, we managed to do a lot of really good broadcasting that did have a following both on campus and off. But beyond that, it really is part of the educational experience of, students who are a part of it. And I mean that not just in terms of the disc jockeys who learned all about different kinds of music and history and global culture that's all wrapped up in the music, but the listeners who were able to catch a lot of those lessons just by listening in. Often, it would be a student DJ flying by the seat of his pants, putting on a record he hadn't heard before and discovering something wonderful and then reading the liner notes. But other times it would be someone really knowledgeable who was sharing that knowledge with the community. And I think that what college radio needs to do is to make that known to people, that that experience is available, that education is available, that just sort of the weird joy of listening to someone experimenting and taking risks that you can't do on a commercial radio station or even on a lot of public radio stations, that there's a place for that. And that's as true now as it was 25 years ago.
A part of college radio or community radio is this underground music experience. And when I read an article that stated that college radio is dying, they mentioned that one important thing with college radio is that it's giving these underground artists a venue, whereas college radio is the first to kind of expose these underground artists, which then, more mainstream, music outlets will then pick up.
I mean, that was one of the sort of the currents of college radio, especially in the 1980s, was this feeling that it was kind of a farm team for a lot of bands. And it did serve that role, although the better stations made sure that they didn't just serve that role, that they also explored not just your classic, sort of college rock tech fans, but they would get into, jazz and world music and other areas where, they're not necessarily ever going to make it big. That role of college radio was blunted a bit when alternative rock became a big deal in the 1990s, and a lot of these bands, suddenly had like the sort of mainstream success, but it's always been part of what college radio does. And this is especially true with local music. And this is one way that, the Internet is not just, and isn't always a good substitute for radio, is having something that's based in a particular community that can showcase, the musicians that live in that town or near it and are doing interesting things. And maybe they'll make it big someday and they're just starting out. Maybe they're too experimental or too retro or otherwise outside, off the beaten path to make it really big, but they're still worth listening to.
And I also understand that college radio is threatened right now for financial reasons, because there's some stations elsewhere in the United States. I don't believe it's been happening in Michigan, but college radio is being sold off for public radio stations. I think most recently that happened at Georgia State University. Can you talk more about why that's happening and the impacts of that shift?
Yeah, I mean, in Georgia State, I think they have sort of a half-and-half arrangement where the students still have the radio station at night, and in the daytime they're only broadcasting online, and it's a more conventional public radio station in the daytime. And, stations have been sort of fully pushed off the FM dial at, Vanderbilt, Rice, University of San Francisco, and other places. And what's basically happening is the universities are discovering that they've got these potentially valuable licenses that they could turn into a profit center. And the students, even if they're doing well enough to support themselves in terms of getting enough donations to pay their bills, which often is the case, they don't necessarily have enough money to raise to buy a valuable broadcast license from the university, so they're not able to make a counteroffer. I should say the counterexample to this, which is a really interesting case, is WFMU in New Jersey, which used to be a college radio station. The college itself went under, but the people who ran the student station managed to raise enough money to take it over, and it's still going strong. But what's unfortunately what's happening in a lot of places is that, you know, they're being sort of taken over by these sort of public radio empires that are doing, you know, I mean, often it's, you know, good radio, but it's radio that you can hear someplace else on the dial, which is not often the case with these college stations that are getting displaced.
So what do you think college radio needs to do in order to stay alive and vibrant and relevant in this day and age?
Well, I mean, obviously, the situation is going to vary from one town to another, from one campus to another. So I can only speak sort of broadly. But make sure people know you're there. Make sure students know you're there. When I went into Michigan as an undergraduate in 1988, being a DJ seemed like something cool to do because you grew up listening to the radio. Nowadays, kids don't necessarily have that idea that they're going to go seek out a radio station. So you've got to go out and make the pitch to them. Make yourself known in the community. CBN does this, sponsoring concerts and, you know, film showings and so on. So they do a good job of letting people who aren't on campus or aren't students on campus, maybe they're involved in some other way, know about the things they do. But other college stations, you know, it might be just those people in the basement and they're not getting across, you know, what they're doing that's so important. Have partnerships with, you know, other people in the community, other institutions in the community that are involved in music or the other sorts of material that you broadcast. And if it's possible to get your hands on the license yourself, you know, go for it, because you don't want to be have everything sold out from under you after, because this can happen even to a station that's really put down roots. So that's a long shot for people just because of the financial and legal requirements. But if there's any way to do it, that would be great.
And what did college radio mean for you when you were at WCBM in Ann Arbor?
Well, you know, people ask me what I studied in college, and it says history on my diploma, but I tell people, in fact, I majored in the campus radio station and I minored in the campus newspaper. And I have to say, if you look at what I've, you know, done with my life since then as a journalist and a historian, and who, among other things, often writes about music, it's really come from those two things I did, you know, the radio station and the newspaper, in some ways more than what I did in the classroom. And I think it's great that on the one hand, the Internet has opened up so many opportunities for young people and all people to do much of this stuff without the assistance of a radio station, but to do it as part of a community that with a particular place and a particular group of people who see each other in real life is something special that the Internet isn't always able to replicate.
And finally, Jesse Walker, do you think college radio is dying?
I don't think it's dying. I think that it's going through a rough patch right now, and I don't know what college radio will look like 20 years from now. I don't know what radio in general is going to look like 20 years from now, because the industry in general is being battered, and who knows, you know, what the AM and FM dials are going to be used for once everybody's able to listen to internet radio in their cars. But I think that the people being able to do interesting, informative, and creative broadcasting on campuses and elsewhere is not going to go away.
So in radio lingo, as always, we will stay tuned.
That's right.
Jesse Walker is a former DJ at WCBN, Ann Arbor student-run community radio, and author of Rebels on the Air, an alternative history of radio in America. Jesse Walker, thanks so much for joining us on Stateside.
Well, thank you.
Stateside, I'm Emily Fox, in for Cynthia Canty. And I'm a millennial. My generation has been described as lazy and entitled, a generation who needs instant gratification and has a short attention span. Ouch. That doesn't sound good at all, especially considering millennials will soon dominate the workplace. How will that generational shift impact the future of Michigan? Morley Winograd has an idea. He spent most of his life in Michigan, and he's a co-author of three books on the millennial generation. Welcome to Stateside.
Delighted to be here and coincidentally be in Michigan to be able to talk to you.
That's right. I guess you live in California these days, right?
I do, but like every good Michigander, I'm up north for some time in the summer.
Well, we are very jealous. Well, Morley, you're very familiar with this group of people born in the early 1980s to early 2000s. How would you define millennials?
Millennials are America's largest and most diverse adult generation. They are an extremely united in their beliefs and optimistic generation. Despite their diversity, they tend to be in alignment on a range of issues where two-thirds of them tend to think one way and agree with their peers. So they're a very tolerant generation, and that has brought us major shifts in public opinion polling on such subjects as same-sex marriage and legalization of marijuana, all driven by this millennial generation and their upbeat attitude towards the future.
And how do you think millennials differ from baby boomers in these characteristics that they have?
Baby boomers, of course, are two generations prior to millennials. In between, we have the often neglected Generation X. But baby boomers have always been a very divided generation. They fought over the Vietnam War on both sides in terms of pro and con. And they have taken their cultural divides into our nation's conversation. They're responsible for the gridlock and partisanship of Washington and our politics, because boomers are very focused on values. They're very value-driven, inner-driven, ideologically oriented generation, whereas millennials are not only tend to be united in their beliefs, but they're also pragmatic idealists. They look for what works, often at the local rather than the national level. And as a result, they tend to want to get things done to make the world better as opposed to argue about it.
And how do you think this might influence the workplace in the future?
There are now these three generations in the workplace, boomers, Xers, and millennials. They're very different, each to the other, and they present a real challenge to management. Much of our corporate workforce leadership is boomers. They're workaholics. They try and motivate people through rhetoric and appeals to win-loss competitions, none of which works with millennials who want to work as a group. They're looking for win-win solutions. And both of those conversations tend to pass Gen X by, as since Gen Xers are a bottom-line, risk-oriented, entrepreneurial generation. So we have tremendous motivation and leadership challenges. Overall, the increasing presence of millennials, as you pointed out, more than one out of every three Americans, adult Americans, will be millennials by the end of this decade. Overall, their increasing presence in the workforce will cause the top-down, command and control kind of style of leadership that older generations favor to go out of style in favor of something much more inclusive, much more group-oriented, much more bottoms-up.
And let's bring it more closer to Michigan now. I mean, considering Michigan was a huge manufacturing state and unions held a lot of power, that's not so much the case right now. How do you see millennials really impacting Michigan?
A couple things. First of all, millennials are the only generation in public polling that expresses support for unions today, a majority support. So they, because the unions are a collective decision-making organization, they have some appeal to millennials. That does not make millennials, you know, management versus labor confrontational type workers. Quite the contrary. They're not into confrontation of any kind. But there is an opening there for unions to regain their strength with different kinds of appeals to their potential members. And in Michigan, the current brand of politics, which is very confrontational and very win-lose, is not likely to appeal to millennials. So there does remain an opening here in the state for a change that would be more millennial-oriented. One thing that listeners might be surprised to learn is that among 20 to 29-year-olds, can't do the whole range of adult millennials right now, which would be 18 to 33 because the census doesn't do it that way. But among 20 to 29-year-olds, Detroit, Michigan, was in the top five in growth of that age group between 2010 and 2013. And Grand Rapids, the second major population center, was 13th among the 50 or so measured major metropolitan areas in the country.
And why do you think
that is? So millennials are increasing their presence in Michigan. But one thing to keep in mind is that growth rate, which was significant, over 6%, starts from a very low base. Detroit ranks 50th among 52 major metropolitan statistical areas in terms of just the absolute presence of 20 to 29-year-olds. But that is beginning to shift, and people, millennials, are coming to Michigan.
And why do you think they're coming to Michigan? Are people traveling to Michigan, or is it just people are getting older?
No, I think what you have is the ability in Michigan for people to buy a house. The affordability of housing in Michigan is dramatically better, and actually throughout the Midwest, than it is in most of the country, certainly in the coastal areas. And as millennials enter the age group, late 20s, early 30s, throughout the 30s, where people start families and settle down, they're looking for places they can afford that have some of the neighborhood amenities of single-tract housing in suburban settings. What's missing, of course, at the moment is a lot of more economic opportunity, educational, good schools, those kinds of things that would really make it attractive to millennials. But it begins, it starts with the affordability of housing.
And as you said before, that millennials are really attracted to local issues. So considering that these millennials are coming to some of our urban cores, especially Detroit and the state that Detroit's in right now, do you think that millennials will have real impact on the city looking to the future?
Yeah, we need to be careful the way the census measures that. It includes Detroit and its suburbs. But even when you narrow it down to just Wayne County, for instance, that same growth rate is present. And I think what millennials are going to bring as they settle down is obviously a greater concern for support of environmental issues and measures. They're going to be looking for more cultural amenities and maybe starting some of those themselves as they enter their entrepreneurial years. I think you're going to see them focused on fixing things at the local level, not looking to Lansing for the answer necessarily, or the state or even national government, but rather buckling down and trying to make things better at home.
So it seems like, based on your research, there's a little more to millennials than just them being lazy and entitled. Would you agree?
Well, I don't actually think millennials are either lazy or entitled, but those are the kind of epithets that generations often throw at other generations. We tend to be critical of people who don't think and behave like us, and generations differ in their behavior and attitudes. Millennials themselves will tell you that they have less of a work ethic in comparison to their workaholic baby boomer parents. And that's certainly true. It doesn't necessarily make them lazy so much as working differently. Their entitled attitude, which some people ascribe to them, comes from their very high expectations and self-confidence that we can thank their boomer parents for having the way they raised them.
Morley Winograd is a co-author of 3 books on the millennial generation. Thanks so much for your insights.
Delighted to share it with everybody, and it's great to be back in Michigan in the summertime.
You're listening to Stateside.
My failure. My failure.
My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
And now, a story of failure from Failure Lab in Grand Rapids. Here's Miranda Kroniak.
So my story isn't going to be a very glamorous story. There's going to be no cocaine, because poor people can't afford cocaine. There's no partying, and there's nothing really funny. It's a common story. I can't get a credit card at Target. So we'll start with my childhood, because you'd really like to hear about that. I'm from a place called Onondaga, which has no consonants, I swear, and it kind of like vomits out of your mouth. It's like, I'm from Onondaga. And it's not a good place. It's in Michigan. I point to it, but you should never go there. It has exactly one stop sign. It has a biker bar, and it has a gas station that before the smoking ban, you could smoke in the gas station. This is Onondaga. So I grew up in a large family. My parents had 6 kids within 8 years, which is madness in a lot of different ways. I grew up like a very Tom Sawyer-esque childhood. There may have been some torturing of frogs. I climbed out of trees. I ran through cornfields. I had dirt on my face, blah, blah, blah. But I was poor. And the thing about being poor when you're a kid is, like, you don't know that you're poor until someone tells you. So even before I found out that I was poor, like, we were pretty smart little kids, and we'd get together. We had a kid council. And my older sister and I were, like, in charge of kid council. We'd pull together the kids, and we'd be like, overheard mom and dad talking. We don't have a lot of money this week. So, Allison, we go to Meijer and you ask for something, I swear to God, we are going to kick the out of you. And so we regulated ourselves. I knew that things were tight, but it didn't seem abnormal to me that they were tight. And it wasn't until I told a friend of mine, this is like 4th grade, her name was Melissa Janeway, I was like, man, we went to the coolest place last weekend. It was below a church, and the food there was so cheap. I got Cheese Whiz for 50 cents. We never got name brand things for like getting like an actual Cheese Whiz for 50 cents. And I was like, this place is awesome. It is the best store. And it wasn't until she told her mom, and her mom like started giving me things like, oh, you know, she's outgrown this, so why don't you take this? That I kind of figured out, like, was that not a store? Maybe that was a different thing. And it took a little while to kind of realize that we were not wealthy. We weren't even middle class. We weren't even working class. We were, like, lower class. So we're going to fast forward, you know, go through high school, all kinds of, like, poor kid hijinks, blah, blah, blah. Crappy cars, everything that happens. And then I graduate. I go to college, which is a big deal. My father did not graduate from college. And I had $647. It's a specific amount that I've, like, never forgotten. $647. And I've basically been independent ever since then. But it's because I was really good at being poor. So I lived in the Morton House. Like, if you're not from Grand Rapids, let me describe the Morton House to you. The Morton House is the worst possible place for a 19-year-old girl to ever live. Roaches, two different species. The Germans are the worst because they're fast. I'd still now, when, like, things move, I have like this peripheral vision of like roaches in my life. 5 years of that was really great. It was really dangerous, and I paid $25 a month with utilities. So that's how I basically got through college. But that's also when I messed up. And we're not going to jump quite to that yet, because I'm going to talk a little bit about what poverty really feels like. So thinking about like how to describe to you, what is this about? Money to me is the enemy. It is the enemy. And it's not just like, oh, I'm having a slump right now. I really wish we had more money. Things are really tight. I'm talking about like Hatfield McCoy shit. Money has done nothing good for my family ever. My mother, when she was growing up, had one pair of socks and they were red because she lived in Southern Alabama, and red socks could hold the clay stains better. And every day she went to school and everyone made fun of her. Because Charlotte had one pair of socks, and she would say to them, but they're clean. I wash them every day, but it didn't quite matter. So when I talk about money as the enemy, money feels like it's literally killed people I know. It probably actually has killed people I know. Because all throughout my generational line, on both sides, no one has ever had it. Now, I actually kind of do have it, but it doesn't matter. Because I hate it. I can see what it's doing to my parents. I know they have a double mortgage on their house. I don't know how they're ever going to retire. I see my siblings falling to it. Because it is the enemy. So if you think that money is the enemy, what are you going to be really bad at? You're going to be really bad at money. Because even in good times, money's not good. Good times are like, well, we have a little bit of money. So what we should do right now is just like spend it on something. We should buy a flat screen television, because if we don't, if we wait too long, it's going to go to the roof. We're going to run out of propane over the winter. We're going to be cold, but we've already been staying in one room. We've like rationed it as much as we can. Like, you need to spend it on the one thing that's going to make you happy. You're going to go on vacation. You're going to buy a TV. You're going to buy a bunch of crap you don't want at Walmart and put it in your garage. Like, that is the way. So money is the enemy. And because I was never given the language, I can't speak the language, which is a really strange thing, because my husband, who's not from a poor family, speaks it, and it's like he's speaking Spanish, and I just don't understand, because I never inherited the language to understand what I'm supposed to do. So I can't qualify for a credit card at Target, because my credit is so bad. It is so very, very bad. It's almost indescribably bad, which is really odd, because I live a life that's quite glamorous for a lot of things. I go to galas, I go to fun things, yada, yada, yada. But when I go to Macy's and I buy that like BCBG dress, I'm like, looks awesome, and I go to gala, and they say, you know, you could save 20% if you got a card. There's a little part of me that just like little burst, like, but because I can't save 20%. Because I can never get a card. So I got into debt. Now, if I told you what my debt was, it's going to mess up the story. So my debt could be from me going to Banana Republic and, like, buying all the clothes. My debt could be from cancer. And then you'd be like, oh, so sad. Not her fault. It could be student loans. And then half of you would be like, mm-hmm. But then other half of you would be like, so sad. Like, probably the younger half would be like, student loans are going to kill us. Ninja servants. So you don't get to know what my debt is because it's not about your pity. It's not about how we treat people because of how they got into debt. It's the idea that debt can destroy you from the inside. I am perpetually stuck at a 23-year-old level. I can't qualify for a car. I can't get a credit card. Everything's in my husband's name because I am a liability. I am also an executive director. And those two things are really strange. And so you would think, well, I'm 31 now, I'm an adult, I'm taking charge of my life. I would still f up. Like, I, if given the power, would still mess up. And it's only because I am married to a person who understands the language that it even works at all. Because I would have a garage. And I would put lots of in it. Like the Barbies I always wanted. All of the things. And so my failure is the fact that I am stuck at 23. And I'm not 23. And everybody else is passing me and they're buying houses and they're doing these things. And I've created an entire lifestyle to make up for the fact that I'm a failure. I love apartment living. Houses are just a bad investment. Lie. I love shopping at Goodwill. Like, so good at it. Lie. I lie and I cater my life. You know what I really like? Walking to work every day, even in the winter. No! That is a lie. But I have made my personality to completely cover this failure, which I've never, ever expressed. I have created a person that hides an entire failure, and I have created a life to hide the fact that I don't qualify for a credit card at Target. Thank you.
That was Miranda Kroniak telling her story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com.
And that's today's Stateside. I'm Emily Fox. Thanks for listening.